In a world where nothing is as it seems, where men speak to God and sleep with other men's wives because he told them to, where being a Mormon is super awesome, and fake ancient church artifacts come alive before your very eyes. There is a museum unlike any the world has ever known, and only two men are brave enough to reveal its secrets.
Freaking awesome! This is a museum! I cannot tolerate this type of chaos!
Unleash hell!
Oh my God!
Can I have a kiss?
Whoa!
Fire up the iron horse, boys.
Oh! For crying out loud!
Come to work with me today.
You won't be disappointed.
This is so not worth 11:15.
This is Sage and Tom's Night at the Church History Museum.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Hey everyone, Sage here. You might remember me from such infants episodes as On Being Sage Turk and Disproving Santa, which, between you and me, probably should have been titled Santa Apologetics, but it's too late now. So on September 29th, 2015, the church released a policy stating that... Actually, sorry, I got my scripts mixed up here. Let's see here. Here we go. Yes, on September 29th, 2015, the church reopened its famous Church History Museum on Temple Square. Now, the Church History Museum had been closed for about a year, and all that people knew was that it was being heavily remodeled. Well, when it reopened its gates, instead of the sort of stuffy collection of pioneer memorabilia, instead, what the church revealed was a multi-million dollar state-of-the-art museum experience. Now, having recently resigned from the church, I was hesitant to go check it out, but in the end, my incredible love for museums in general won out. However, I knew I couldn't do it alone.
Hey, this is Tom.
Hey, Tom, it's Sage. So, do you know what the church reopened? It's History Museum?
I'm in.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe you and I, we could head down, maybe check it out.
Oh yeah, dude, I'm in.
Yeah, I mean, I hear they actually have, like, the seer stones on display, so I don't know, it could be pretty cool.
I'm totally in.
So with Tom at my side, and with a frankly unhealthy obsession and love for museums in my heart, I present to you a virtual tour of the Heavens Are Opened exhibit at the Church History Museum on Temple Square. Now, before we get to the museum, and for those of you that have not yet experienced the magic of Temple Square in person, allow me to paint a picture of the most magically Mormon tourist trap on Earth. First, naturally, is the temple, but of course, since nobody can go inside, it's not the real draw of Temple Square. In fact, for all the temple really does on Temple Square, it might as well just be a giant, life-size statue of a temple. And then there's the tabernacle, with its giant sort of pot pie facade. You can go inside, you can see an acoustics demonstration of them dropping a pin on one end of the building and listening to the sound on the other, or you can listen to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir if you're willing to get up early on a Sunday morning and go make the trek. Now, the real draw of Temple Square are the two, count them two, visitor centers. Now, Visitor Center 1 is the one that everyone knows. That has the giant space Jesus, as Mark Maron so lovingly termed it. But on the second level, below that, there's a whole host of living dioramas of various Book of Mormon scenes. You have living animatronic characters of Nephi and Moroni and Mormon. It's pretty hokey, it's pretty cheesy, it's been there for a while. It's a little funny, it's harmless. The second visitor center, it's a little bit more high-tech, it's smaller, but there's various touch screens and movies that will play, and a lot of it's really just the latest in church-sanctioned videos and propaganda. But when it comes to propaganda, there is no better example of the church's current policy and strategies around honing its message than the Church History Museum itself. Located just across the street, so essentially still on Temple Square, the Church History Museum is a two-story monolithic building whose sole purpose is to tell the story of the church's history from its own, let's just say, slightly biased perspective. So about a week ago, Tom and I, we met in the parking lot, grabbed our handy-dandy pocket microphone recorders, and then hand-in-hand, or at least, well, shoulder-to-shoulder, walked into what turns out to be one of the most impressive museum displays we've ever laid eyes on. The Heavens Are Open exhibit was, right out of the gate, incredible. Moving graphics, screens up on the wall showing videos, obviously custom produced for this exhibit, showing preachers, pastors, voices coming out, lots of stories being told all at once, and that was just the lobby. So what you will hear over the course of the next hour or so is going to be the actual audio recordings of Tom and I going from exhibit to exhibit, trying to explain kind of what we're seeing, giving our first impressions. There was kids there, it was a Wednesday night, so of course mutual activities, so you do have to bear with a little bit of poor audio quality, but hopefully between that and us interspersing kind of our thoughts, you can get a better idea for, honestly, the state-of-the-art place of church propaganda in the year 2016. All right, are you ready? Let's get cracking. So the very first thing that happened in the museum is we were approached by two sweet little women at the front desk.
Would you guys like to take a survey while you're in here?
Sure.
If you want to do it while you're looking at the exhibits.
If I get a hold of the clipboard, it makes me look so official.
It does, and...
Can I put my coat with my bag?
Yes.
Sorry, by the way.
I'll take it in. And when you're finished and you bring this back, I will give you a coupon for a little candy over in the...
So it's a sugar bribe? Okay.
Sugar bribe. Will that work?
All right.
No, just take it with you and do it while you're going through.
Now, the survey is important, and you'll find out why later, but what was really interesting about it is that clearly it was geared towards non-members, and even though Tom and I were trying to keep a pretty low profile, somehow we had been singled out as being said non-members, and as far as we could tell, for the whole rest of the night, we were the only two that had actually been given these little clipboards with the four-page survey on it.
Here, you could stuff that in the movie, Doors of the Open.
Okay, thank you very much.
That I deserve the wrath of an angry God and the pains of everlasting punishment.
It's intense.
I tell you, man, when I take you out, I'll take you out.
The movie Tom mentions we'll get into in just a second. First, though, was the Living Cabin exhibit. This was a partial recreation of pioneer-era log cabin, supposedly similar to one that Joseph Smith would have found himself in as a boy. And everything in this cabin was able to come alive. So there were pictures on the wall, sort of these silhouette-style images of his grandmother and grandfather on both sides, artifacts that had various audio clips. There were little trays to open up and explore. Let's hear a little bit of some of the impressions we had of this living cabin.
Okay, so you made mention that there was an actual stone. Is there really?
I cannot subscribe to any particular system of faith.
Let's see it over here.
I contend for the ancient order established by our Lord Jesus Christ and his apostles.
That's Joseph Sr.
But if you remain a member of no church, all religious people will say you are of the world.
And if I join one denomination, all the rest will say I am not. Envision the Lord of the Church. The world is a
Disney. The grandparents, what are they?
True. Well, my parents were so poor that they apprenticed me at the age of four.
It's like a puzzle.
Instead, I pursued earthly riches.
That's actually kind of cool. It's like a photo that's animated.
And my father was a church deacon.
Is it creepy that I actually think they're going to move in to kiss? Is that creepy at all?
Now, right off the bat, one thing was crystal clear, and that was that the church had spared no expense. The level of technology and sophistication in every single display was really impressive, actually, and kind of made it fun to sort of explore who Joseph Smith's ancestors were, learn a little bit about his grandparents. Even seeing some of the pottery shards and some of the artifacts from daily life was pretty cool. Now, next up was one of the parts that we were most excited for, and that was the church's newest filmed representation of the First Vision. And wouldn't you know it, Tom and I were just in time for the very next showing.
So we're going to watch a movie on the First Vision?
I think so. Maybe that is going to be one.
Dude, the screen is like...
Oh, yeah.
It's like better than IMAX, because you have to actually turn your head to catch it all in.
Is it going
to
be the next best thing to having the First Vision?
Well, arguably it could be better, but yeah. Yeah.
It's all around you. I just hope, like, the voice of Satan, like, attacks you from the back, like, surround sound.
Oh, my God. You know those, have you ever done those 4D theaters?
Yeah.
Where they're, like, blow wind or...
poke the back of your chair.
Yeah, like Bug's Life. It doesn't Disneyland, right?
Oh, man, if they did that.
As soon as he grabs you, like, there could be, like, a rumble in the chair, and then somebody from behind grabs you.
I'm not gonna lie, that would be so great.
Now, pretty soon, the movie began, and honestly, because we don't want to get busted for pirating, we decided not to record the actual movie itself. So, just as an overview, what we saw was a screen that was thin. It wasn't as immersive and large as IMAX, but it wrapped further around your peripheral vision. And the way that they had filmed it was really incredible, that all the perspective was correct, so you could look around you and kind of see what was happening. You know, Joseph sort of walks out into the woods, which is really what you're seeing the entire time, is a single scene of this part of the sacred grove where Joseph walks in. He finds his place in sort of the middle of the screen and kneels down and begins to pray. And then the darkness appears, the music swells, God and Jesus show up, and we're pretty sure that they were actual, like, CG creations, although they looked pretty good, but again, it was kind of far away, so it wasn't a close-up, and the camera angles never changed. It was always just... you were sitting there as if you were watching the First Vision play out in front of you, and it was happening in almost 4D. It was really, really impressive. Let's hear what we had to say after the movie was over.
So the trippy part to me was that it's like the screen is all bent, so it takes in all your peripheral.
Yeah, and they actually...
if they had fans, dude, yeah, it'd be a full 3D experience. Yeah.
I actually was impressed that it wasn't just, like, wrapping it around, like, clearly.
Yeah.
Because, like, the perspective was correct when we were looking at it. Like, it took some doing.
That was
pretty interesting. I thought it was crazy. Right off the bat, they were like, oh, yeah, there's 9 different counts of this bad boy.
Now, the audio gets a little hard to hear, but one of the most interesting things that we saw right off the bat when the movie started was that it actually throws up a title card that fully admits that there are 9 separate accounts of the First Vision. Now, that was pretty interesting to me, and it was really indicative that this was the strategy that the church was going to take, trying to get in front of these more controversial things, but present it in a way that's still faith-affirming, if you will. So, the movie begins, there's a black screen, it says, you know, there are 9 or so different versions of the First Vision. This is what is considered to be the most accurate account. Then the movie plays, and what's really interesting is that it wasn't actually the account that most everybody's familiar with. I can't remember which actual account it is, but the one that you remember giving as a missionary, it's slightly different. So that was also interesting that they were willing to go there. Now, speaking of getting in front of controversial things, right off the bat, the very next thing that we saw as we walked out of the theater was, well, I'll just let the audio play. It's the stone. Tom, it's the stone.
Joseph Smith was being prepared for the monumental task of translating a large book of scripture into his own language. The published volume had nearly 600 printed pages. It would deepen and expand the spiritual understanding of millions of people. God prepared practical help in the form of physical instruments that would aid in the divine translation process. The use of such aids to communicate God's power and inspiration mirrors accounts in Scripture. In addition to the Urim and Thummim, the Bible mentions other examples of physical instruments being used to access God's power.
They're showing you two,
the rod of Aaron, a brass serpent, holy anointing oils, the Ark of the Covenant, and dirt from the ground mixed with saliva, which Christ used to heal the eyes of a blind man. The sacred tools Joseph used were stones that aided in the translation process. Joseph Smith consistently testified that he translated the Book of Mormon by the gift and power of God.
That's the out.
Consistently.
That's
consistently said one thing.
But see, that's the cover-all.
Yeah. Well, and yeah. What they're skimming over is that this is a totally different thing that he used to find treasure. But there you go.
Well, yeah, they can't exactly. That's not exactly faith. You know,
Yep, it's true. The seer stones were front and center in this museum. Well, they weren't at the actual seer stones, but a huge picture of them, so both of them blown up to probably like 7,000 times life size, and then this huge corner section that was devoted to really trying to explain the idea of the stones. Now, one of the things that was pretty interesting was this reference to seeing stones in the Book of Mormon that neither Tom nor I were familiar with, and well, let's just say we got a little schooled, but let's listen to what happened.
Huh. Wait a second.
Okay, hold on.
In the Book of Mormon, the Lord gave the brother Jared two stones that would magnify the eyes of men. Things written in an unknown language. So they're using that as a...
Wait a second.
That's in the Book of Mormon.
I remember being given two seer stones, but whatever.
Well, wasn't that... I don't remember either. I don't have the great...
Like, how many stones did this guy make?
Well, didn't he do... He just touched the one.
Yeah.
To light it up.
Yeah.
Light up the little...
Those are the
tight
only,
as a dish submarine.
Those are the only stones of this...
Wait a second. Okay. Huh. Well, it's gotta be right. Are you gonna call BS on it? I'm gonna call Ether through...
Okay, pass the Lord's son of the brother Jared, behold, thou shalt not suffer these things which you have seen to go. Okay, so he gives him that whole vision of everything when he sees him. When ye shall come unto me, ye shall write them and seal them up, that no one can interpret them, for you shall write them in a language that they cannot be read. Behold, these two stones will I give unto thee, that ye shall seal them up also with the things that ye shall write.
What two stones was that?
For behold, the language you shall write I have confounded, wherefore I will cause my the stones shall magnify to the eyes of men.
Oh my God.
You just got schooled, man.
Holy freak.
I don't remember that.
Well, I mean...
Huh. But he's just saying he's going to, like, the stones that I just gave you, you're going to, like, seal up with it.
I
guess he's saying, I will cause my own time, the stones shall magnify to the eyes of men.
Can you go to the chapter heading? Is this the one where he does touch the stones to make them glow?
Yeah, because then he sees the finger. Yeah, right here.
So
the brother Joseph sees the finger of the Lord as he touches 16 stones. Christ shows his spirit body to the brother.
Okay, so it's the glowing stones that will actually confound his mind to read different languages?
Well, then the interpreters are provided to bring the Jaredite record to light.
Jeez.
Oh, wait, because isn't it like... So when they find the Jaredite records, the Urim and Thummim were like sitting in there with them?
Was it?
Yeah, because that's like...
They
bring it to like Moroni or whoever to like interpret.
So they brought it along in the cell.
Because that's the one that Joseph Smith got.
The Jaredite record?
Well, the Urim and Thummim. That same one.
It's the same one?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Because he's basically in the Book of Mormon saying, like, this is where these things came from. And they're the same ones.
Yeah, that's pretty meta, though. Like, yeah. So as he's doing this thing, he's like, oh, yeah, they did this.
I'll tell you, Joseph Smith is nothing if not meta.
So the brother of Jared was given the seer stones before Joseph Smith ever had them. Who knew? But then again, maybe, you know, I've lost the spirit since resigning. Oh, well. Next up was one of my favorite parts of the museum, and this was the story of the Book of Mormon and the translation of the plates. Now, they really skim over the translation of the plates more than they could have. I was expecting sort of a living hat to look into and maybe a glowing stone, or maybe you could actually move the curtain back and forth and fool your friends. But instead, what they had was the various hiding places of the Book of Mormon, and the way you were able to get to these hiding places was you crawled into a little hollow log that had little picture windows inside of it. So, of course, I jumped into that log.
We got a tub of beans. We got underneath some hay.
Okay, what?
These are where Justin hid the plates, man. It's like I'm the plates.
Do you feel?
Find me, Tom. in a box.
Hang on, I gotta spin around four times and then go blindfold.
Let's see, an empty box full of sand. Here's a cloth covering a brick. Oh, underneath the floorboards. Oh.
Wow.
It's pretty great.
So, of course, no church history museum could ever get away without a replica of the actual golden plates. Now, these ones were sealed inside of sort of a glass box. You couldn't touch them or handle them, but it was a supposed accurate representation of what the plates look like, including the characters, as Joseph Smith called them, that were eventually brought to that Professor Anton or whatever. And so that was interesting, actually seeing their recreation of the gold plates. But more interesting was Tom's reaction to it.
Dude, what I wish they had is, have you seen the ones that the Tanners made that are like 300 pounds?
Yeah.
It's like impossible to make.
Yeah. So what I love about this is the rendition of the golden plates, right?
Sure.
And it's in a case, and it's also in a big wooden box that clearly wouldn't be able to shut. But I love the hieroglyphics of Reformed Egyptian that's on the plates.
Which, these are like the legit ones. These are the ones that, like,
it's gotta be legit.
Yeah. No, yeah, these are the copy ones. Do you remember? Have you ever seen those copies of the Book of Mormon that used to have like the gold?
Yeah, it was
copies?
A gold cover.
Yeah,
and it had like the little.
It had those things, and then it had like all these pictures, like Mayan ruins. It was just like, this is probably what happened. Who knows?
Well, they were thinking, now this is what totally happened.
Yeah, they said it kind of like, this is a likely location or something.
Now, throughout the museum, there was sort of this recurring type of display, and it featured various characters from Joseph Smith's history, so family, acquaintances, and there'd be sort of these tall kiosks with a vertical video that looked like a sort of like a sketched portrait of the person, and you would touch it, and then it would come to life. And an actor dressed in period piece that still kind of looked sketched was talking to the camera and giving you a little snippet of their story. I'm going to play two of them. The first was Oliver Cowdery, and the second was one of Joseph Smith's sisters. And you can kind of hear the way that the church sort of presents these people. And again, these little micro snippets of their story.
This is actually pretty impressive. Like,
oh, this, like,
with tech.
They spent serious money on this thing, man.
Dear okay, brother Oliver. Joseph,
Oliver,
I received your letter yesterday, bearing the date October 22nd, 1829.
Please let me translate, please.
I had for a long time expected to hear from you, so your letter was gladly received. My only motive in this writing is to inform you of my desires to be freed from sin and to rest my soul in the kingdom of my Savior. And my Redeemer, when I begin to write of the mercies of God, I know not when to stop. But time and paper fail.
Catherine Smith Salisbury treated Joseph's injuries after an attack by ruffians. Ready for Harry Potter magic?
Ruffians?
Ruffians. Ne'er-do-wells.
I was at home when my brother Joseph burst through the door, out of breath and nearly exhausted,
so she's 14.
And threw himself on the couch. He was clutching the package with the gold plates against his
sister,
side with his left
right?
hand. And his right hand was badly bruised.
Oh, no.
Joseph told me that three men had leapt out at him from behind a fence. He hurt his hand striking one of them to get away.
Oh, so he saw it then, too?
Then he ran with the plates until he was out of breath.
Like those plates, which are...
I looked after Joseph until he was breathing properly again. And I examined his injured hand and treated the bruises on his knuckles. I never saw the plates because the angel had forbidden Joseph to show them at that time.
Oh, no.
But I did have the package set on
the
table.
The angel was like, he'll totally ruin the surprise.
But he was carrying a bag... And he got assaulted, and I would have seen him.
That's
no way, Jose.
It's like, sorry, man, I'm busy. I need him back, like, immediately.
I'd show him to you, but you got to tend to his wounds first. And then maybe.
Now, another sort of recurring motif throughout the museum was this idea of living timelines. So there were several kiosks that would sort of explore different periods of church history, and each one had a little bullet or bubble you could tap on, and it would, you know, explore deeper into that event. There was one event that was brought up, but I don't know, left a little vague.
It's interesting. So we have the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood. Not a whole lot of details around this one. We don't have a date.
Well, we have a date of when it was painted oil on canvas in 2015.
Ah, finally.
No, yeah. Clearly it was by the river, I guess.
I guess so.
Now, there was another whole section about the printing of the Book of Mormon that was really crowded. I mean, obviously, this was one of the pieces that members were super excited about. There was a wall of... how tall the first printing stack of copies of the Book of Mormon looked like, and you could like do little typesetting games and activities. And throughout the museum, there was always these sorts of things, little interactive, you know, build your own, you know, little artifact, or you could, you know, create a little craft, or in this case, put together some type and do a tracing on it, and it was interesting, but not really too much to dive into. Not nearly as cool as what was next. Probably the most interactive, high-tech portion of the entire museum was this one wall that was totally a touchscreen LCD monitor. So every piece of the wall you could touch and explore. And the first thing on the wall was this map that showed the eastern seaboard and also the shoreline of England, and all these little church history dots all over the place. And not only could you explore like hundreds of these locations and just keep diving deeper and deeper and listen to audio tracks, and it would zoom as you'd click on it. It was incredible. But there was also a game. Basically, you were tasked with getting the converts from England across the sea to the Americas. So let's hear what it was like to play with a bigger than life size touchscreen ship floating game.
Ready to sail to the States?
Jeez, dude.
Here we go. Start game.
There's a game?
Okay. We're sailing. Here we are.
Man, watch where you're going. You don't want to crash into another boat. Don't watch for the rocks. Watch for the rocks. That's actually pretty impressive.
Dude, this is harrowing.
Yeah, it's like... You fire cannons at it?
Sink the other convert boat? Who's going to make it?
It's like civilization. Like, you have to build a lot of wood, put settlers on an island.
That's right. Gotta build a surplus of women. Oh, come on, man.
Wow. Oh. Check her. You're going slow. The wind current's not pushing you fast.
I know, but I'm trying to avoid the rock. all these lives.
How many people are on your boat?
It doesn't say.
Oh, you turned your sails off. No wonder you stopped.
I'm gonna beat the boss man at the end.
Yeah, Bowser's gonna be right over
here. Let's get the axe. Oh, the winds have changed.
Whoa! Oh, no. Oh, the missionaries. See, that's what was on. That's what was on board.
Damn! Look at this, man.
Well, after we got done sinking all of our virtual converts, next was a section that was truly highlighting some early church characters, early church persons. They highlighted Brigham Young, of course, and we'll talk more about Brigham Young a little bit later. They also highlighted Sidney Rigdon and Oliver Cowdery and Heber C. Kimball. There wasn't a lot there. It was sort of artifacts from their life. And, you know, of course, little cutesy tidbits about them. But it got Tom and I thinking.
Like, you can't find a timeline of Joseph Smith's life that makes sense. No one's done it. People have put together events, and some people have put together the revelations, and some people have kind of, like, explored the polygamy angle, but there's nothing that's, like, a single source. What happened?
Well, and when I think of Sidney Rigdon, I can't help but think of, like, Crazy Sidney. Because he could, and he ends up going more or less crazy at the end. Yeah. And starting his own church, and just doing all that crazy stuff. And, like, Oliver Cowdery.
Yeah.
And how he was trying to blow the whistle.
Yeah.
On his, Joseph Smith.
And yet you've got, like, what is it, Section 88 or something like that, where Sidney gets that, like, shared vision with Joseph, like, the whole olive branch or olive leaf one.
And he was really close to taking over.
Yeah. But what's crazy is, like, then you got guys like Heber C. Kimball, and you read some of his writings, and this guy was, like, before he ever met Joseph Smith, this dude was having, like, visions of, like, blood seeping up from, like, the ground and crazy bonkers stuff. And you just have to imagine, here's a guy that's having, like, legit crazy visions. Joseph Smith is showing up, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm having visions, too. You know, like, why don't you come?
Oh, you had those too?
Yeah, I was going to tell you. You have the crazy one where, like, the trees uproot and there's bodies underneath and it's all the Gentiles. He's like, yeah.
And there was
totally.
There was a guy, his name was Joseph, and he prophesied about me. Do you remember that?
Now, there was one early character from church history that never once made an appearance throughout the museum that we thought was a shame. They really could have made some sort of a cool interactive experience around his life.
Oh, there's the powder muscle.
A flintlock pistol by Newell.
Here's what I don't know if they have anything about is good old Porter Rockwell.
Oh!
Dude, can you imagine a first-person shooter? You got, like, the
mayor of Missouri.
There's mayor, sides. There's Governor Potts. Bang! There's that one apostle who was trying to say bad things about him. Bang!
That'd be great.
You might be able to tell from these recordings that the general structure of the various sections of the Heavens Were Opened exhibit followed the rough timeline of church history. So you started with, you know, Joseph's early life, and then sort of moved into the New York period, and then the Kirtland period. There was a section that had looked like sort of the facade of the Kirtland Temple, and you went inside and there was paintings that many of us were familiar with about the temple. Not a ton there, though. Not really much about the temple in Kirtland, or even what is the idea or deal with temples in general, but it was interesting. Then came the end of the Kirtland period, and before you could move on to the next section, I was pretty impressed that there was actually a giant safe door that you had to sort of spin the little wheel thing to open it up. And before you opened it up, below it, it said, you know, what was one of the reasons that the early saints had to flee Kirtland? I was pretty interested to see what was inside.
It's behind the vault, you ready? It's like a Pulp Fiction.
Oh my gosh.
What was inside? Well, it was a single note. A banknote, actually. It was a banknote that had been produced by the Kirtland Safety Society. So right there, front and center, the church was talking about one of the all-time giant fuck-ups of Joseph Smith's career. But I mean, they were diving into it. There it was. Now, there wasn't much about it. It showed really just the bill note, and then there was one plaque inside of the door as you opened it to explain what it was you were looking at.
Much of the unrest stemmed from a failure in the Curtin Safety Society, a bank-like institution established by church leaders in general. A bank-like institution because they...
anti-banking society.
Bank-like. Partly as a result of the crash of the national economy later that year, partly... That's an important word.
It's not all caps, but it could be.
The safety society closed, causing some members, including a few prominent church leaders, and, well, don't really matter who, to criticize Joseph Smith, but most of the Kirtland saints supported the prophet and gathered to Missouri.
Wow.
Joseph Smith fled from Kirtland to Missouri in January 1838. To reflect the fact that the society was technically not a bank, the note was hand-stamped so that it read, Anti-Banking Company.
Yep.
The fact that it was not supported by anything remotely resembling capital, the titles of cashier and president were crossed out, and Sidney Rigdon and Joseph Smith signed their note as secretary and treasurer, respectively. I was just like, never mind, not a bank.
Open the safe door to learn more about why the saints left Curtin. Yeah, that's why, all right.
Now, you simply couldn't have a museum about church history and the life of Joseph Smith without talking about Liberty Jail. And sure enough, the Heavens Are Open exhibit delivered. So there was an actual recreation of the Liberty Jail cell with its low ceilings and sort of hay in the corners, and it was just jam-packed with kids trying to see what it was like to be imprisoned alongside Joseph Smith.
It's where all the cool kids hang out, man.
I just want to recreate that scene. Either you be quiet or I will. What is he saying?
Oh, look, they get sort of hugging and stuff.
I got some eyes on him. Thou shalt try and form all thy thoughts.
Just picture Joseph in the corner.
These things shall give thee experience. It shall be for thy good. Hold on that way.
There's no way the jail was this nice. Tile.
There should be like realistic urine smells. Like the pot in the corner.
Yeah, instead of a broom, yeah.
What was strange, though, is that there was really nothing to it. So there were some little speakers in the corner, so when you got yourself in there, you could sort of hear, I guess it was supposed to be Joseph Smith talking, and he was quoting DNC section, 121, 122. But really, there wasn't much about it. It didn't talk about how long Joseph Smith was in Liberty Jail, or certainly not why. So it was just kind of there. And it was really popular. But we're going to move on. So the next section was about Nauvoo, and this is where things got pretty interesting. The first thing we noticed is that this is where historical documents, like actual originals, started showing up much more frequently. And it was pretty interesting, the ones that the church decided to trot out, and it would be behind glass, it would be up on the wall. And the first one was what was called the Nauvoo Charter. Now, apologize, the audio for the Nauvoo section is pretty noisy, and that's because there was just a ton of people by this time at night. Lots and lots of families and youth groups and things had come in, so again, apologies about the quality of the audio, but it does give you a sense of kind of how many people were around and the popularity of this thing. All right, let's take a listen.
Nauvoo Spiritual Constitution. Wait. Oh, so Doctrine and Covenants 124. They're saying is Nauvoo Spiritual Constitution. I've never heard of that before.
I've never heard that before either. The Spiritual Constitution.
Many saints desired copies of this revelation before it was published in the 1844 DNC as Section 124. An act to incorporate the city of Nauvoo. Well, man, I don't know. I mean, nobody denies that Nauvoo was freaking awesome. Grew into a big city or whatever, but... the Nauvoo Charter. Nauvoo's secular constitution.
Don't get too confused.
Oh, wait. Memories of the Missouri persecutions led the saints to seek a powerful city government for Nauvoo. Recent convert John C. Bennett help the prophet.
Who's a comfort guy who you should in no way recommend? John C. Bennett.
Help the prophet draft a charter for Nauvoo, which the Illinois legislature approved on December 16th, 1840. Wow. I'm actually surprised they even mentioned his name.
I know, yeah.
Now, naturally, that was the only mention of John C. Bennett throughout the whole museum. And then the other thing that we saw right next to that was plots of the general layout of Nauvoo, and Tom had a pretty interesting observation about that.
Can you find Joseph Smith's home?
Oh, dude, I got this map on my mission.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, then you already know. Where's Joseph Smith's house?
Well, I just remember thinking, dude, that's the exact size of his nose. Because if you flip his profile picture, it's like, oh, that's perfect.
You purposely did that?
Like
the Dubai Islands that look like a...
Well, it's like, is it really that smooth all the way around? No way.
That's awesome.
Now, the first real interactive portion of the Nauvoo section was the red brick store, and it really was the front facade of a recreation of the red brick store. It was pretty impressive. And the doors and windows were actually screens, so you could see people moving around inside. There was all kinds of action and activity, and, you know, sure enough, that door, you could touch on it, really sort of, quote-unquote, turn the virtual doorknob, and it would open up. And then you could hear conversations taking place inside, and it was just jam-packed with women. Now, the Red Brick Store holds a lot of significance for Nauvoo, and there's a number of pretty important things that happen there. Let's hear a little bit about what that display had to say.
Whoa. Can I open this door?
Don't do it.
I can.
I missed the doorknob.
Turn it.
Oh.
I don't know. I'm on a desk.
No, somehow it opens because
they've
opened it before.
Oh, there it is.
You
figured it out.
Touch, yeah.
Instead of using the doorknob, you use the swipe, yeah.
There were really high-tech doors back in ancient Nauvoo, I didn't know.
Only as long as it needs to be. Me too. I'm a Melissa Figler, is that you?
This means like Joseph's view, like peeking through the window.
No, I'm joining the Relief Society.
Yeah, I'll take one.
Oh, my.
Sorry, I heard it's even hotter upstairs.
I don't know what that was.
Because that's like the red brick store, right? Yeah. Or the red brick loft.
Or was it the...
Bash,
where
is there perhaps...
The red brick store. Was that the...
She is. That's what it was like,
too. Here's even hotter.
Did they mention it?
The store was the setting for several important events, such as the introduction of the Temple of Knowledge.
Wow. Oh, and the organization of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo.
This is the place. Wow. So Joseph picked the place for all the women to gather in the same place he would marry.
So they're all upstairs, and he's like, dude, just get this. All the ladies are downstairs. All of them.
Guys, this worked. I can't even believe it.
They got a club. They can call it whatever they want, but like...
That's not how he just kind of like wait till they're on a group of news. He's like, I'm here. I pronounce all of you. Like Nacho Libre just baptizes them like instantly.
Next was a little section around the building of the Nauvoo Temple. There was a sunstone, and there was a couple of ropes and pulleys you could actually kind of yank on and lift up these granite blocks, and, you know, it was kind of cool. And let's hear about one of the actual sunstones that we saw there.
Ah, classic sunstone. I've got one of these in my house.
No sunstone. I think this is actually... I think it is a sunstone.
No. Can't. Well, I guess it could be.
Oh, replica.
Oh, it fooled you. Just like everything else in here.
When will I ever learn?
So by this point, you might be thinking, what about all the controversies in Nauvoo? Well, don't worry, the church museum has you covered. So in one section, there was a little display that we lovingly called the Wall O' Controversies. And basically what it was a series of flippable tiles. So on one side of the tile would have a complaint or a controversy, levied at the church. And then you would flip the little tile around, and then it would give the actual story or the reason for it. And there was probably a dozen or so of these sort of mini controversies. Now, it was pretty high level, it was pretty surface level, but it was interesting. Again, the church trying to get in front of maybe some of these things. And even though the audio is a little rough, again, in this one, let's take a listen to some of our impressions of this wall of controversy.
Voting, non-Mormon saints who all voted for the same candidate were manipulating the political system in an undemocratic
way. Yeah, influenced by Mormon leaders. Of course it is. Well, no, it's not. No. Saints who all voted for the same candidate were legitimately exercising their democratic right.
So they were not manipulated at all.
I love how it's just saying the same thing, just, yeah, but guess what? It was legal, so screw you.
And they were just exercising their rights. They weren't manipulated anyway.
We're going to say that was what? Economic cooperation among the saints, concentrated wealth in Mormon hands, and threatened the economic prospects of neighboring non-Mormons. They're becoming a monopoly. But really, economic cooperation among the saints and consecrating their property label to the church fulfilled a religious duty to care for the needy and build up God's kingdom.
Makes sense.
As a monopoly.
I don't know.
Gathering converts from across the earth, exploited native foreigners, and strengthened the economic and political powers of the Mormons. Guess what? Those native foreigners are actually Lamanites, so they have it coming. Gathering faithful from across the earth was religious duty. I love how they're just like,
it's just a religious duty for saving souls and
like
building up God's kingdom. Yeah.
The Navajo religion was a dangerous religious military. Also, awesome. Provide a legal and practical defense against the kinds of attacks and persecutions suffered by the saints in Missouri, yeah.
The council.
That one was like hidden, man.
Dude, that is intense. Alright.
Okay.
Council.
This private council undermined the separation between church and state. I mean, that's putting it lightly. This private council fulfilled a religious duty, once again, to be prepared to govern God's kingdom at the second coming of Christ, which was any day now. The early saints expected the second coming would occur shortly. Which that in itself is kind of like you turn it again and it's like, oh, but don't worry, when we say a generation.
Nothing to see here, man.
I would love if this next one was just like, look over there, free gift shop. Like,
it had an arrow. Like, look that
have
way.
Have you seen the fantastic collection of pottery we have? Keeper St. Kimball. Joseph Smith's campaign for president of the United States was evidence of his thirst for power and desire to institute religious control of government.
That's a bit much.
Campaigning for president of the United States allowed Mormon views to be publicized. The saints sought redress for Missouri wrongs. True.
Whatever,
true.
Dude. Whatever.
Habeas corpus was abused by Mormons to defy the authority of higher courts. Provided a constitutional means for the saints to defend themselves against unwarranted arrest.
That's the only reason, too.
Yeah.
Jeez, dude.
Plural marriage was evidence of Mormon moral depravity. Indeed. The saints who had been asked to live the principle of plural marriage because they were obeying a revelation they had given them from God. Is it really like the only like counterpoint is just that they were told to by God, so it's okay? I guess so.
Yes.
I kind of thought they would have said something like, yeah, but they didn't like it.
Have you seen some of those early Mormon movies?
Now, some of you might be thinking that if this is the Mormon church that I know and love, then some exceptionally brief, high-level micro-mention of polygamy is probably the best we're going to get. But no, 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 you would be mistaken. There is actually a kiosk dedicated entirely to polygamy in one section of the Nauvoo quadrant of the museum. Now, it's kind of hidden, it's a little bit in the corner, but it is there, and it's another one of these sort of living story kiosks. So there's multiple kind of characters, and you can listen to sort of audio from actors giving sort of journal entries, and it was interesting. It was interesting that it was actually there, front and center, and some of the characters they had actually chosen to highlight were interesting as well. Now let's go ahead and listen to Tom and I diving into the polygamy kiosk.
Here we come to the crown jewel of the exhibit.
I thought we started with it, with this Sears doll.
Okay, you ready? Read the accounts of saints.
So the test
faith was tested.
A test of faith, the saints, and world marriage.
Yep. Let's see who we got.
Bathsheba Smith, husband George A. Smith.
Yep. Doesn't say who her.
There's no animated movies done for this.
Oh, I think there might be one of them or two of them.
Sarah P. Rich, husband Charles Rich. Wow.
I think they actually have. Okay, so there you go. That's...
husband Joseph Smith.
Another woman then played dared not let it be known, and nothing but a firm desire to give commands to the Lord could have induced a girl to marry in that way. I thought my trials were very severe in this life. Jesus. And I'm often led to wonder how it was that a person of my temperament could get along with it and not rebel. But I knew it was the Lord who kept me from opposing his plans. Although in my heart I felt I could not submit to them. But I did, and I'm thankful to my Heavenly Father for the care he had over me in these troubling times. One more. Have you read The Sacred Loneliness yet?
No, but I own it. I've skimmed through it and read bits and pieces. Have you read it?
Yeah. It's rough.
I haven't even listened to the Year of Polygamy.
Yeah.
That was actually my wife's, what
did it for her.
Yeah.
She got really into that, and Lindsay Hanson Park and following her and listening to the whole thing, and then she got in Sacred Loneliness, and suddenly it was just like,
yeah. Dude, it's too much to handle.
It's too much. Because it's not even like, for her, it wasn't even like some of the more scandalous stories that would get people. It's just that for her, it was like, these were real human beings that have just been buried.
Yeah.
Totally buried. And she started like we talk about Brigham Young and his 30 wives, and you couldn't name a single one of them. It's like, nobody cares about these people.
They were totally thrown out by the wayside.
They're cattle. They're literally, they were just bartered and bought and traded. It was like,
and they had no voice. They had nothing.
Ugh. Oh, this poor guy.
Do you know his?
Warren Foote? No, but I'm just like, oh.
Yeah, he does look
kind of
sad.
Do we really care about the dude?
why do you... I mean, you were the guy that was recruiting all the women. Come on, man.
He's like, oh, I have to bang.
He was appointed to teach the principal. Oh, that's why. Lucy Walker.
Dude, I like that they actually pick a chick that looks like she's freaking 13 years old.
Yeah, that's true. No, a few months short of 15.
Sorry. Yeah.
Isn't that what he said? In the Sarah Kimball?
A few months shy of 15. Oh, so.
Isn't that the most. That sentence is always bothering.
Oh, they bring this up.
Uber C. Kimball and Balate Kimball? As related
Violet.
To Violet Dunn. Is it Violet?
Dude, this is Hallmark Kimball. This is
the youngest
one.
Related by the
but she's telling the story. Okay, hold on. His anguish and my mother's were indescribable when able to.
Wait. My mother had noticed a change in his looks and appearance, and when she inquired the cause,
he
tried to evade her question.
This is rough.
But it so worked upon his mind that his anxious and haggard looks betrayed him daily and hourly.
Okay,
so they're essentially saying
she's telling the story of when her dad
had heard the news about the proposition,
and then
that he anguished over it.
Because it was
going to
be
him,
because it was actually going to be for her to be one of Joseph's wives, and then
why would they even talk about his suffering?
And then Joseph comes back and he goes, just kidding, it was a test.
Yeah.
I'm actually here for your 14-year-old daughter. What's his name? What does learn more? What do you got for me? Ah, there's no known photographs of these people. To learn more... Oh, good.
And it's the very last slide, too.
To learn more, go to LLS.org and search field enter... Exactly this.
Yeah, there's no link, man. You gotta search that.
Dude,
good luck remembering that.
Oh, buddy.
Because that story is pretty intense, where he tries to say, I'm, want to take your wife.
That's frankly one of the most intense, yeah.
It is. And then when he says, oh, man, your daughter will work, though.
it hurts my brain and my heart.
So again, the audio is a little tough to hear, but essentially what you have is the church essays come to life. And if there is a simple way to describe the entire museum, it's that. It really is almost each one of the church essays given life, given interactive things that you can play with and explore and touch and really sort of obfuscate the actual meat of what's being talked about, which is, frankly, some pretty controversial and disturbing things. So that is how the church handles the story of polygamy. A single kiosk above it was framed, an original written paper that has DNC 132 on it, which was disturbing, to say the least. Now, right next to this kiosk, obviously in an attempt to sort of direct your attention away, is really, I think, what a lot of people come to the museum for, and that is all of the artifacts around the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, including a huge mural portrait of the mob, sort of in two panels, the mob coming up the stairs, right at the door, and the doorway and sort of the wall marks the halfway point of the painting. And on the other side, it's Joseph and Willard Richards and John Taylor and all these guys in the actual jail, and it's very realistically rendered, and it's pretty impressive. Also, there was the clothes that Joseph Smith had been killed in. The death masks were there, which had been in the museum before, and all kinds of cool stuff. Let's hear a little bit about some of these artifacts from Joseph Smith's martyrdom.
Pepperbox pistol. Is that the pistol?
Wait a second. No way. Okay, so Cyrus Willock smuggled this pistol into Carthage jail for Joseph Smith. When the armed mob attacked, Joseph fired the pistol in self-defense, wounding some.
Well, and killing
one. He crossed the room to a window where he was shot. Then he fell, mortally wounded, to the ground.
He more than wounding some. He killed at least two guys with this thing. This is a murder weapon used by the prophet.
How many? Yeah, that's a six-shot barrel. That's a pretty cool-looking gun.
It is pretty cool. I wonder if it does them all six at once, just like, whang.
John Fillmore brought this single-shot pistol into Carthage jail for prisoners to use self-defense. So there's two guns.
So hire him, wow.
He grabbed the pistol, but he's fatally wounded. He fell to the floor. I'm a dead man.
Poor, sad Hiram Smith, man.
That's a pretty big barrel, too.
Dude, this, yeah. I think I'm weighing something, too, I'm sure. Ah, here's the beaten stick.
No, is that it? John Taylor's watch?
There you go, man.
Is that the bullet?
Owned by John Taylor. That's the bullet mark right there. That's the deal.
If that's not physical witness of something miraculous, I don't know what is.
Exactly. He went on to become the third prophet of the church.
Yeah, he did.
It's amazing.
Right when polygamy was at his height.
And his buddy that he was wife swapping with, Willard Richards. It's amazing. And this is his walking stick.
I'm actually...
calls it a rascal beater. Oh, those rat! Look at these rascals. All these rascals.
They got mud on their faces. Fancy beanie. That's pretty intense. I'm actually shocked that they mentioned the gun.
Yeah.
Smuggled in and shot, wounding someone. Well, that's pretty impressive.
Wounded someone. I mean, wounded them until they died.
So by now we were getting towards the end of the museum. Really the only other section after the martyrdom was several different areas that discussed sort of the aftermath. Of course, a majority of it was about the trek west. But there was one pretty surprising mention. There was a little wall, and on it was a section that talked about some of the various schisms that occurred after Joseph Smith's death. And there was a dude that we had at the very beginning of the museum made bets that there was just no way at all that the museum would ever mention it, and that was James Strang. And sure enough, on this little wall, they actually made mention of him. We were pretty stoked. Let's hear our reaction.
Yeah, it's a session.
They named him.
So they got
my mind is being blown right now.
right now.
So they got Brigham Young. They got Joseph Smith.
We found James Strang in the church history museum.
Joseph Smith III, Sidney Rigdon, James Strang, and then Lyman White. Lyman White, they mentioned. Even though his was pretty short-lived.
But still, they mentioned in 1850 he had between 4,000 and 6,000 members.
Yeah.
They actually mentioned it.
Yeah.
Today, I love that they're actually rubbing it in a bit. Wow. Today, 300 members like a chump.
Forgive me. Today, 15 million plus.
Give or take some. Whatever. We don't care. We're not about numbers.
And it's also the biggest picture, the biggest arrow.
Boom! Community of Christ. I love if it had 250,000 instead of plus, it had like a minus. or less.
That's awesome.
That actually is blowing my mind that you even mentioned it.
I'm actually impressed.
The Church of Jesus Christ of the Children of Zion, the Church of Jesus Christ Vicar Tonight is what it's called now. That's interesting.
Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints without the hyphen and a capital D. That's the Strang Church.
Yeah, there you go. That was the important change.
They still have that trademark from what I understand.
Now, if you're curious and you want to learn more about, say, the Bickertonites or the various factions that broke off after Joseph Smith, I highly recommend checking out one of the latest of the Brother Jake videos about the different sects of Mormonism, which is pretty cool. Now, this was the essential end of the Heavens Are Open exhibit. There was a few more, you know, mentions of pioneers and other things like that. But really, that was the meat of it. And there was tons more artifacts and cool things, including a cane that was made out of Joseph Smith's coffin and had a lock of his hair embedded in the top of the cane, which was super creepy. But then there was an entire second floor of the museum, and we're not really going to get into that. But the second floor was more of their permanent exhibits, and that included a very small section on the Relief Society. A little bit about some of the art that's been produced by church members. But one of the key and interesting portions was really this Hall of the Prophets. So each president of the church had basically a little diorama display of various artifacts from their life. And really, the highlight of it was of course, Brigham Young's, including Tom's reaction to it.
I think he is the man, the myth, the legend. Shall we have today?
I'm already feeling sick to my stomach.
I don't even want to know.
Dude, no way. There's a ring, a singlet ring.
Dude, he had it on his big chubby finger, you know. As he just like stroked that,
so,
like, white cat.
So let me guess. There was, for as much blood as he had on his hands, metaphorically, do you think some of that metaphoric blood got on that ring?
It was originally a white stone. It's like a blue ring, but more people die under your ring.
It turned blood red. You're guilty of murder.
Yeah, I'm like waiting for like to get stopped over to like come and get us, by the way. I saw this like lady come in, I was like, they're laughing at us.
We're laughing with him, not at him.
The Deseret Alphabet. A raging success.
Well, it would have been.
I can't imagine life without letters like Super S, backwards L.
A staircase N. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Double A N.
Yeah, that's like an at sign
Vagino.
Inside.
After exploring some of the other less savory artifacts from Brigham Young's life, we could tell that we were approaching the end of our journey.
I'm getting the heebie-jeebies, dude.
The heebie-jeebies.
The Brigham jeebies.
Now, before we could conclude our tour of the Church History Museum, there was one final thing that we had to do. You remember the survey from the very beginning? Well, it was time to bust that bad boy out and see what it had to say. I'm going to go ahead and play the audio. It's a little long, but it's pretty interesting what questions the church was willing to pose to people that you could, again, tell they assumed were not members or visitors. Let's go ahead and listen to Tom and I as we fill out our surveys, which it turns out were two different versions. His was different from mine in a couple significant ways. Let's take a listen.
All
right, we're filling out the survey of how our experience was.
Okay, so it's asking how old we are. Are we baptized members of the church? Male or female?
How many times have you visited the museum in the past 2 years?
On a scale of 1 to 5, how much do I enjoy going to museums? And how much do I enjoy learning about LDS church history?
Yeah, we both put that we love going to museums in general.
Love it.
And I put 2, not very interested in learning about LDS church history. You put 3.
I put 3. So I mean, you learn about the coffin stick.
Yeah, that's true.
Or Brigham Young's thimble condom. Like, that's pretty...
You didn't use a condom. You're the one that educated me. You educated me on that.
Okay, I got the more interesting, was it interesting section, so... Was it interesting? Scale of 1 to 5. Photos of the Seer Stone. Paintings of Joseph and Emma.
Yeah, you had a totally different...
Joseph's preparation and audio recording. A video pillar of people who assisted with the Book of Mormon. Spinning Blocks, which was a dud.
Yep.
Alvin Smith's Lap Desk, which was a dud.
Yep.
Hill Cumorah in the Log, which I got to crawl inside and see the...
That was intense. That you felt like you were there.
I was there. I was waiting to be discovered by Justice Smith.
Hill Cumorah, while we had to do his dig.
The stone box to, like, close the lid.
Yep, that's true.
They probably have that, and so many kids died in it, they had to get rid of it. Interactive scribe table, meh. Printing wall activities, interactive drawers, the Grandin Press, and the document case of the first edition pages of the Book of Mormon. And what section caught your attention? Well, the theater, which was like four-dimensional, which is amazing.
Yeah, so in mine, it just talks about video picture wall, Jesse Towns, and Joseph Smith, Sr. Bell.
I've never heard of any of this bullcrap.
You don't remember seeing some of this? Like the Lucy Mack Smith footstool.
I remember being in awe of the footstool.
But the Vision Theater, like you said,
that was
intense. It was a panoramic movie thing. And how long was it? About 5 minutes, maybe?
Yeah, if that. And it was awesome.
It was intense.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was filmed very well. And they must have used CG, but...
I actually do think that the two guys were CG.
I think they might be.
God and Jesus.
But it was really well done. And they did incorporate a lot of the first visions. They mentioned 9 different versions.
I honestly feel like I was in the 5th of the 9 first visions. Yeah. I was there.
And they actually did a really good recreation of the whole Satan taking him over.
Because you have that peripheral vision and it starts creeping in.
Yeah, on both sides.
Both sides, and then suddenly it's all...
I kept looking both... Because you have to turn your head to get it all in. I kept looking like, are we going to actually see Satan?
If you could have actually seen his little face in the back.
Or like a pitchfork come out the one side.
just real quick.
That would have been perfect.
Oh, man.
That was good.
They missed the opportunity for that, and also like the electric shock, and also maybe some of the fans blowing, so... Yep. There's some to be desired, but pretty good.
It was pretty good.
Now we get to one of the more interesting sections, which says, how transparent or honest do you think this section is about the history?
This really is the only question they should have put on the survey, really.
Yes.
I'll just skip mine.
It's so interesting that they even ask it.
Oh, it's fascinating. How transparent or honest do you think this... This section is about the history of the LDS Church, using the scale from 1, not at all, to 5, very.
Okay, so I'm conflicted on this, because as far as transparency goes, it's more transparent in terms of actually mentioning things.
Yeah, like you said, the gun that they smuggled in Carthage Jail.
Okay, so we got the gun. We got James Strang.
James Strang and Joseph Smith III and Sidney Rigdon.
They actually mention... that Helen Mar Kimball, like,
that's pretty transparent. And
the Kirtland Safety Society.
And there's a pretty decent section on the Seer Stone that quoted a scripture from the Book of Mormon.
The section that had the little flippy cards that literally was like all the arguments for that you find out are total crap because it was the duty of the saints to do it anyway.
But like we said, each moment of transparency is couched in vagueness, ambiguous, or ambiguousness, or whatever.
Much ambiguous all over the place.
But I don't know, to answer that, how honest were they?
Because I want to put a 1.
Not at all, yeah.
But I do have to hand it to them.
There were.
In this sort of backhanded way, they're like, see, nothing to see here. It's a fun, interactive exhibit. That in no way represents how truly fucked up this is. Okay. I'm going to give it a 2.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
They tried, but...
Like, baby steps, right?
How would you rate your knowledge of the translation and printing of the Book of Mormon before and after the section of the museum? Before your visit...
Yours is different than mine. Would you rate your knowledge of the discussions about religion going on in America and within Joseph Smith's extended family before and after your visit to the section of the museum? What?
Okay. How much did you know... How much of your knowledge of the discussions
about
religion
going on in America and within Joseph Smith's extended family before... Oh, so they're trying to gauge what I learned about
the religious landscape.
Wow. That's a pretty intense question.
That is pretty intense.
I don't feel like I learned anything here.
Well, mine was asked, how would you rate your knowledge of the translation and printing of the Book of Mormon? Pretty straightforward. I'm going to say before, I had a lot of knowledge. After your visit, no thanks to them, I still had a lot of knowledge.
Oh, you don't feel like you got dumbed down at all? So you lost knowledge?
That's a good question. No, because I learned about how big a stack of Book of Mormons look like if you got 5,000 strong.
That's true.
I never knew that before. And what it's like to hide in a log as the precursor of the Book of Mormon. So the central message in this section of the exhibit.
I want to say to show off the money that was spent. That's what I want to write. Because the touch screens, I mean,
to show.
How has that not come across as anything as braggy, we got money that very little museums have about showing off of?
I actually remember feeling like legitimately conflicted about like when the church would produce like a really nice movie. It was like, God's church is like a Hollywood level production studio. Like, I guess that makes sense, but doesn't it also feel weird? Like, I think I might have felt weird, yeah, about if I didn't know anything about the church and I just showed up and it was like, like, this is a slick operation.
Oh, yeah. I'd be like, whoa, how did I not hear about this? Because a lot of dough got thrown here.
Yeah. Personally, I wish I had this on my mission, because I would have loved bringing people in.
Oh, my gosh,
theater.
Yeah. I'd have been like, you want to know how true we are? Look at these touch screens.
I'd have been like, I'll see you on the other side with your baptism pot ready to go.
Watch that first vision video one more time.
Kick them in the entrance and just wait till they come out.
If you didn't feel or see something because you were turning your head around, oh yeah.
All right, so now it's time to bring back the man, the myth, and the legend, the partner in crime for this exploration into Mormon history. Tom, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Sage. You know, the next best thing to actually going to the church museum with Sage was listening back to this episode. Honestly, Sage, thanks for doing all the legwork on this episode. He was the one that came up with the original idea, offered me the gracious invitation, and then went through the process of editing and adding all the commentary throughout this episode. I personally know how daunting a task that is, so I wanted to publicly thank him for his work and his efforts. Hell of a nice job, man. My afterthoughts of this experience was that, one, I had a lot of fun on this, for sure. And secondly, I did find myself pretty surprised with some of the areas of transparency. I got thinking back, I would have loved to have seen this museum when I was a kid. The church is in a position that it has to get out in front of its history. There's no other choice. Like Elder Ballard recently said, gone are the days when a student asked an honest question and the teacher responds, don't worry about it. Yeah, he's right. This is the information age. And seeing these baby steps of transparency the church has made does in some way surprise me, but then again, not really. I mean, their hand is being forced, and now they're putting out these, quote, essays that are hard to find and show the Seer Stone and the Kirtland Safety Society note in their museum. Whoop-dee-doo. I shouldn't be too surprised, because again, isn't this what we should expect from the church, being reactive instead of proactive? I want to give the church a thumbs up for this, but in a lot of ways, it's just too little too late.
Hi, my name's Chalice from Clearfield, Utah, and I like listening to Infants on Thrones while shopping at Deseret Industries. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.